Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Thank you so much, Brian Brown, as always, our founder and the creator of the Brown Briefly. It's so helpful every week to hear your wit and wisdom as you introduce another conversation here on Vachon Maury Islands about the events of the day with some of our Brieflies, our tried and true friends of the show, and some special guests today. So let's dive right in and hear how things are going. So first of all, I want to welcome Truman O'Brien and Bruce Hallman, and we're expecting Lynn Kerrigan will be joining us, we hope. But Truman and Bruce, how's it going?
Good. Thanks. It's a Truman here. Right.
Great to see you.
Sure.
Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning. Doing well. It feels like summer may be on the way, finally.
Oh, we can hope. Oh, my gosh.
Right. I mean, we may get above 70 this week, right?
Yeah, woohoo!
and we might have sunshine before the fabled July 5th, which when I was growing up in the Northwest was always the day when you're sure to get good weather. So anytime after the 5th.
It was the day that the switch was thrown and summer started, right?
That's right.
Sometimes miraculously, just like the 4th, the rainy, cold, and drizzly, and then the 5th would dawn bright and sunny. So, maybe that's a sign of independence. I don't know.
But in my show earlier today, I said that today was my least favorite day of the year because it's a day when it starts going, the daylight starts going the opposite direction. I always look to December 21st as my favorite day when they start going the other way. And this day is the saddest, you know. Oh, well.
I'm feeling that more and more. I totally agree with where you're at, Truman. Well, hey, I'd like also to introduce, we have some special guests. We have Marilee Runyon, well-known amongst Vachon, particularly the progressive persuasion types, and Don Miller. And both Marilee and Don are here to join us to talk about Snake River Dam removal in a session that we're going to call Small Talk. And we'll get to that after a bit. But just with introduction, Marilee, how are you today?
I'm good, Kevin. Thank you. Glad to be here. Enjoying the possibility of summer arriving soon.
Yes. And let's see, you're joining us from the Burton Peninsula.
Yes. Greater Burton, right?
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Okay. And Don Miller, you are joining us from, I believe, off island in Snohomish. Is that right?
Yeah. I live in Arlington, Washington. Yeah. And so, yeah, likewise, enjoying the sunshine this morning.
We can see it beaming through the window behind you. So yeah, it's always a great sign. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about kind of what we've seen. Bruce, you had a commentary in the Beachcomber this week regarding agriculture. Maybe you'd like to let people know what was behind the commentary and what you'd like to see happen as a result of sharing your views.
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's I was asked to give a little, just a talk at the agricultural days at the Mukai Farm and Garden. It was a celebration of Vachon agriculture, you know, sponsored by friends of Mukai in the museum and Viga, you know, a number of organizations sort of contributed to it. And sort of two things I mentioned in the commentary that I thought were interesting. One is we don't often think of it this way, but when you look at the sort of quarter plus mile from the four-way stop in Vachon, where you have just, you know, a lot of way, you have the Vachon Village Green, and you have Viga, and you have the Saturday Market. And then you go a block further, and you have the Land Trust, and then a block further, you have the museum, and then you go a long block further, and you've got the Mukai House and Garden. And it's just sort of like that sort of to me encompasses much of what makes Vachon very special. You know, we've got sort of farm to table agriculture, marketing and farming going on here on the island. We've got the land trust that does a magnificent job sort of preserving wild land, natural land on the island. We've got the museum that tells the stories of Vachon Island. And then we've got the Mukai House and Garden, which is one of the most unique sort of Japanese American sites in the United States. All within a quarter mile. And so I thought that was just something that's worthy of noting. The other thing I sort of have talked about was when the first Europeans came to Vachon Island, they did not see what the Shuabap people, the first people of Vachon Island, were doing as agriculture. You know, they saw the land as sort of being left fallow, if you will, or unused. But in reality, you know, the Shuabap used the island heavily in what we would call agriculture, or using natural resources to sort of to sustain life. And so they had what, and I just love this phrase, they had what they called clam gardens. They were sort of purposefully sort of maintain clam beds around the island, particularly around Quartermaster Harbor, that were harvested, much like we plant and harvest a garden.
Wow.
They also did fire stick farming. Basically, there were large swales throughout the island that were purposefully burned to keep them open, so they would have places for their horses. And there were indications of horses on the island as early as the 1820s. The 1820s. And then also they used it to keep ferns, bracken ferns and wapato potatoes and other kinds of carbohydrates growing. The Shuabap's people had a diet that was heavy in protein, lots of seafood, land animals, but carbohydrates were a real issue for native people. And so they sustained the land by fire stick farming. They had clam gardens. And Europeans came in and they didn't see that as agriculture. Hmm. So one of my commentaries was, we really need to broaden our concept of what agriculture is. It's really everything we do to sustain our life. And if you take that perspective, then we avoid that kind of colonial perspective that only this is agriculture and that is not. So that's the essence of what I was trying to do.
Yeah, Truman.
Yeah, you know, I need to throw out there also, Bruce, that, you know, I worked with forest stewards for a number of years. And and the biomass that's available here on the island and from forestry is huge as well. And, you know, we often talked about one of the reasons that the K2 factory failed is that we were bringing all this outside product here to build something and then shipping it back out. And the real way for the island to be sustainable is to produce things here on the island that come from the island. And one of those things, of course, is the biomass from forestry. So anyway, I just thought I would throw that out there as well, that we need to include that, I think, when we're talking about agriculture.
Sure. All right. And I would have to ask Marilee, because you have, I believe, deep roots, if you will, into the agricultural nexus in the center of town that Bruce described. But tell us, I don't recall all of your affiliations, but I think you're quite involved.
Yes, I am. First of all, I just want to say how much, Bruce, I enjoyed your commentary and the beachcombering, what you just said, and the idea of all of us enlarging our understanding of what agriculture is really a good idea. I'm a longtime vegan member. I started in 2000, I believe, I had a lavender business growing, the Lavender Sisters, with two other women on the island, and we sold at the market. I worked on the market committee. I was the president of the Vega board for many years. And now I'm sort of the coordinator of Vega's Food Access Program, which is the effort we make to ensure that all islanders have access to island-grown food through our Vega Buck program and farm stand credit programs. So, yep, deep roots, definitely.
And a foundation of the sustainability that Truman just discussed.
Yeah. Absolutely, yep.
Fantastic. Well, hey, the other thing that I would like to make sure we cover before we jump into small talk is the Vashon High School graduation parade. And the Beachcomber did a great job, as they always do, of covering that. I don't know if anybody had a chance to see the parade, participate, or they know an Islander who's like making that big transition. But Truman, what are your thoughts?
Hey, I just want to throw a plug out there for Voice of Vashon. Cindy and Jeff Hoyt did an absolutely fabulous job covering the parade, and it was all live and live streamed. And I believe you can go back and hear a recording of it. But I just thought they did a terrific job. They had information about that folk embarrassing things that the parents told about the kids, which was pretty fun. But it was an enjoyable thing to watch, and I was really proud of Voice of Vashon and Jeff and Cindy in particular for their efforts at it.
One of the things I found interesting about it is it's sort of, as a historian, you're always looking at how things impact culture and how things change. And that parade, which was instituted 2 years ago because there was no live graduation because of COVID, you know, so we decided as a community to have this parade through downtown and let seniors celebrate and people recognize them. And as COVID's fading, hopefully fading, mm-hmm. although it seems to sort of continually come back, that's the change that's going to continue. You know, it's that impact of how we modify our lives as a result of a pandemic. And then those modifications become permanent, much like working at home is going to become a much more a feature of people's work life than it ever was in the past. And so pandemics have both positive and negative impacts, of course. But one of them is that we're going to see a senior parade probably for the next several decades on Vashon. And so it's an impact that sort of the unanticipated impact of COVID.
And Marilee, did you have a comment?
I did. I just wanted to say how much I like the parade because it reminds our community that these graduates are all of our kids, that they represent the future. This is an important passage. And I love it that by having a parade in town, lots of folks, even if you don't know a graduate, get to cheer and celebrate and smile and wave and congratulate the kids. And I also will have to say that my eldest grandson graduated from high school.
Hey, you're here.
It's quite an event for me, I have to say.
Nice. Well, knowing, you know, anything that Jeff and Cindy Hoyt produce, and particularly when they're delivering unexpected information in public, is always something to tune into. So, yeah, thanks, Truman, for letting us know how to find that. Hey, one other thing I do want to mention, a number of us Vashonites ventured onto the Olympic Peninsula. And the reason I go here is we usually want to talk about the signs of the changing season and what we've seen. And as we were hiking up to Flapjack Lakes, we heard all through the trail this whoop, 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 whoop sound. And those who've been out there and those who maybe have read about the early exploration of the Olympic Peninsula by white people, recognize that that is the sound of the grouse, and I think it's called thrumming. And we would hear all through, like I said, all through the trail from one direction and then another as they're basically calling and trying to attract each other. Early when the press expedition funded the first transit of the Olympic Peninsula, this is the 1889, I believe. I'm starting to sound like Bruce Hallman now. the year that the state, you know, actually became a state, there was the seeking of what was in this terra incognito on the Olympic Peninsula, and so a group of hardy men of vim and vigor, it was all men, said, yes, we'll go and we'll explore in the Olympics and see what's there and bring back stories. And of course, the press, they turned into the Seattle Times. You know, it was for them an ability to sell newspapers and tell a story. Well, it wasn't far into their trip when they encountered this noise, and they didn't know what it was either. At that time, they didn't know what it was. And so they studied the noise. They kept records of how loud it was and how often and the timing between the noise. And they actually named this area that they were in Geyser Valley because only 14 or so years earlier had Yellowstone been created, which has so many geysers. And they really did believe that this was some geothermal event that they had to record. And of course, now we know it was the thrumming of the grouse. We had the good fortune to see one of the grouse. As I was walking down the trail, I noticed ahead, it looked like a log on the side of the trail was moving. And no, it was the grouse. So we all quieted down. And most of us had a chance to see it in full-fledged, tail feathers alert, big yellow feathers on the chest, exposing the beautiful colors of that bird when it is in courting season. So just wanted to pass that on. I don't know if anybody else would like to share a wilderness observation story with our listeners.
Well, I have just a short one. I set up a trail camera quite some time ago, and it's just been delightful this spring seeing all the new baby fawns show up. And they're so, some of them are so confused. I saw one of them go racing by, and its mother was standing kind of in the shade there. And the fawn raced by, and the mom walked out and looked like, where are you going? You know, what is it? And pretty soon the fawn comes running back like, oh my gosh, Bob, I found you. And running back to her because he had lost himself. Anyway, very, very cute. So that's my wildlife story for the day.
I could just see it. Kids, kids, kids.
Exactly.
What are you going to do?
Exactly.
All right. Well, speaking of wildlife, we have a very important topic to cover again, because last week we talked about the Lower Snake River Dam removal and the significant issue that it represents today, right now, and current actions that are being contemplated by our Washington State elected officials and a number of the issues associated with dam removal, like navigation, irrigation, power, et cetera. I'd like to spend the next 10 or 15 minutes today hearing more about this project from our guests, Marilee and Don. And let me just start out by asking, please tell us a little bit about yourselves and why Vashon Mori Islanders should care about Lower Snake River Dam removal. Marilee, maybe you could get started.
Thanks, Kevin. Well, you know a little bit about me. I've lived on Vashon since, gosh, it's been 30 years, 1992. In that time, I've had the benefit of learning a lot. And I've been struck the last couple of years at all of the community events that begin with a land acknowledgement. And I appreciate that. And it dawned on me, particularly more in the past year, as I listened to them, that this was a first step, and what was the second step? And for me, the second step was, okay, you need to learn about this. It's not enough just to stand here and say, yes, we acknowledge that the Indigenous people have stewarded this land since time immemorial, but what's happening now? So I made a commitment to learn about the Snake River Dams because it seemed like an important issue to Washington, and to do what I could to make that happen. So that's really why I'm here. I'm not an expert in energy or transportation, and certainly not in the agriculture as practiced by wheat farmers in Eastern Washington. I'm definitely a small grower. But I believe that all of us on Vashon Island need to care about this for two reasons. One is obviously the potential extinction of salmon, which are an iconic species to our larger community. They are important not only for themselves, they provide food, to our orca population, their bodies fertilize the forests along the river. They are crucial to the Northwest as we understand it. But for me, maybe even more important, I don't know, more or less, is that it is time for us to start honoring our obligations to tribal nations in this country. This is an opportunity to begin to rectify the wrongs of our effort to obliterate Indigenous people in this country by honoring the treaties that we have made that promise them the right to fish in their usual and historic places as they ceded thousands of acres to white people in the Northwest. And I feel very strongly about that. And I feel like we must move beyond land acknowledgement into genuine action in support of tribal nations and our obligations that we've made. So.
Marilee, I have to say thank you so much for sharing that. I would give I would say, spectacular, and for connecting those dots in the way that you just did. Yeah, it had not occurred to me, and thank you so much. It's so important to hear that. Don, you, I think, have represent some expertise in this area. Why don't you tell folks a little bit about yourself and how you came to see the Snake River Dam removal as an area you wanted to put your time into?
Before moving to Arlington, I lived 35 years on Whidbey Island, so I share some of the island concepts. And, you know, the living on an island, I think the reality of limitations, you know, is a little bit closer. But really, when you think of the Earth, it's an island, too. So really, those same types of experiences apply. I'm a retired nurse and photographer, but my youth, I grew up, my parents had a wheat farm, so we shipped wheat down the Columbia River. And my college years, my summer job, I operated a wheat elevator, and, you know, I'd have 200 or so farmers bringing in their wheat, and you sample it, and, you know, how well the grade turns out, and you weigh it, all that stuff determines what their annual income is. So, you know, they can be a little anxious about that at times. So I know the wheat grower perspective from that lens. Our farm also was next to the Umatilla Indian Reservation. And each year, the native, the tribal members would gift us with salmon, salmon that's, you know, for the most part, pretty rare and not available for gifting like that. They even have difficulty catching salmon for their first salmon feast. So I also look at it through that lens. You know, why this topic is important, I think, you know, there's opportunities here to do a lot of things right, or an opportunity to let things go extinct, to not honor our commitments. And, you know, the choice is pretty clear. They'd like to put a dollar sign on it. I think in the draft report that was released that caught a lot of attention, the $10 billion to $27 billion cost. But there's costs of continuing the dams, too, and they're not insignificant. So I think it's just important for our future in just every way you turn.
All right. Hey, thanks for that overview. So my understanding is that the Lower Snake River Dam removal proposal was initiated. It's a multi-state discussion, right? Folks from representatives from Idaho, I think, first initiated the conversation. And now our Governor Inslee and Senator Murray are engaged in coming up with proposals. Meanwhile, what I understand is there's proponents and opponents to the removal of the dam, and that the opposition has got quite an active campaign right now to say why it's inappropriate from their perspective. Could you comment on the sort of the benefits and of dam removal, and some of the opposition to dam removal, and maybe what our listeners should understand about what they're hearing from those who oppose the removal of the dams? And either Marilee or Don, either one would like to jump in.
I'll go ahead and start. You know, what's I've seen and get a lot of comments to me about are some of the television ads, and they talk about there's going to need to be more coal plants. The electricity rates are going to go up 25%. You know, if you look at the draft report, they don't talk about coal plants. They talk about clean energy opportunities and portfolios. And mm-hmm. So, you know, that 10 to 27 billion that the report mentions, it's important to understand that that's over a long time frame. It's over 50 years. The energy replacement is a big portion of that. And so the money for that would be fronted for the most part by independent energy producers. You look at utilities outside the BPA that have needed to get more energy, and they do requests for renewables. And I think PSE recently requested for 3,000 megawatts, and they got bids for 18,000. So there was plenty of people out there willing to make the power. So if we free up the lines to let them on instead of these dams, we can have those renewable sources. As far as the cost, so again, that's, you know, it's spread over 50 years. The Northwest Energy Coalition, one of the ones that has been evaluating this, looking at proposals, they estimate that the cost of a typical household would go up in the range of $1.28 per month. So that's like for about 4 cents a day, you can have the things we have now plus salmon. For your rate to go up 25%, that would mean your monthly bill would have to be $5 a month. So, you know, if you have a $5 a month a bill, then your rate might go up 25%.
Mm-hmm. I think another important thing to consider is that the government has spent over $17 billion in the last, I don't know what, Don, you'd say, 20 years, trying to keep the salmon from going extinct, and it hasn't worked. The salmon were listed, I think, in the early 90s on the through the Endangered Species Act, and their situation has not improved. So we're spending a lot of money, and it's not doing any good. Why not spend the money on something that will actually make a difference, bring more renewable energy, allow the salmon to make their way through the system? You know, the dams can be breached. They don't have to be removed. They can be breached to allow the salmon to move. And I understand that that would increase the tribal harvest by 29% right off the bat. I think that it's important for all of us when we see particularly advertisements on television and giant page advertisements in the Seattle Times to think about who's paying for those. And those are organizations who are protecting economic interests of their own. I don't believe that all wheat farmers are opposed to breaching the dams. I don't believe that all ratepayers are opposed or are in danger of having dramatic increases in their cost. I think many people know that. But industry organizations, whether they are trying to prevent GMO labeling in the grocery store or the breaching of dams, are protecting economic interests of their own. So look who's funding and make some decisions about that.
Okay, Truman.
So I just have some questions about the actual what's going to happen. I noticed that on the Columbia, of course, there are dams on the Columbia as well. Are those dams, I mean, it looks like there's at least two. Do they have fish ladders? Is there a way for the fish to get past those dams on the Columbia to get on up into the Snake?
All the lower dams, there's four on the Columbia before the Snake River dams, they have fish ladders. But it's not just a matter of the fish getting up. I mean, there's a big mortality as the fish come back down. And so important comparison is the rivers in central Oregon and in central Washington that only have to pass the lower Columbia dams, they're sustaining. And the ones on the Snake, they have double the amount of dams. They have eight dams to get through, and they're not sustaining.
So there are eight on the Snake?
Mm-hmm. There's four on the Snake four below on the Columbia. So that's a total of eight there's ones actually above those four, but they have no fish ladders. But but the area that's being restricted is pristine habitat. It's up in the Rockies, it's up in the Lyell Mountains in Northeast Oregon. It's high elevation. It's in wilderness areas. It will resist impacts of climate change. It's huge. It's, you know, it's 26,000 square miles. That's about the size of South Carolina. So when you want to impact salmon in the Northwest, this really is the place to focus. It's pristine. It's large. We know exactly where an intervention is that will help the salmon. And we know solutions for what to do when the dams are breached.
So are there fish ladders on the, there are no fish ladders on the upper four in the snake. Is that correct?
Hell's Canyon has no fish ladders, though. Yeah, so that's above the lower four Snake River dams. But the Salmon River drains in. The salmon have access to the Salmon River, Clearwater River, right. The Grand Ronde, and other rivers in the Willow Mountains.
Okay.
I mean, they have access now, but it's not very good. I mean, they're not surviving. They're going extinct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it sounds like a good question of... Sounds like a good question, you know, can the fish get upriver? But it sounds like the challenge to the fish survival is the downriver trips. So even the fish ladders don't help us there, it sounds like.
Right.
Yeah, they've done everything they can think of to try to support the down passage. You know, they barge them past the dams, they truck them past the dams, they spill more water over the spillway so it doesn't have to go through the generators. Mm. And all those things haven't helped. They keep dwindling, and also cuts back the power generation of the dam. So if you leave them in place, they're going to have to even further restrict the amount of water that goes through the generators. It's still not going to solve the problem, but you're going to have less power. So I mean, you know, it's just not really making a lot of sense.
Right.
Yes.
Oh, and one other question about that, and I'm looking at these, they all have locks. I mean, each of these dams looks like they have locks. How will removal of the dams affect the transportation up and down the river? Will that have an effect?
So there will no longer be barge traffic between Lewiston and the Tri-City. So that's a distance of about 140 miles. So a good percentage of the grain moves by rail now, so that the other about 3 million tons would need to be switched over to rail. So there's some adjustments that need to be made with that, but most of the elevators along the snake where the wheat is being taken to and loaded on the barge, they also have the option of loading on the rail, so they might need to increase their capacity some. You know, and so then it can be shipped either completely to most of the wheat goes to export, can be shipped completely to export by rail, or it can also be still loaded onto barge at a couple sites along the Columbia near the Tri-Cities and barge the remainder of the way.
Mm-hmm. And the other question, you were talking about sustainable energy. A couple of years ago, I was in Walla Walla and was talking to a local gentleman there, and I commented on the number of windmills that I saw around Walla Walla. There were a tremendous number of them up on the ridge lines up above. And his comment was, "Yeah, we spent a lot of money putting those things in, but they're not producing like they were supposed to." Do you have any information about that? Any numbers on the wind energy that's produced in Eastern Washington?
I don't have specific figures on that. I just know that they've put in, you know, for PSE, they requested mm-hmm. renewable energies, and so they thought it was a viable option for them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Isn't it true, Don, that the Nez Perce tribe also has a rather mm-hmm. fantastic plan to generate renewable energy, which will support the tribal livelihood and also contribute to renewables to replace the energy that will be
lost. They started a solar project. So the dams average output, the four dams, is about 1,000 megawatts, and peak is about 3,000. And the BPA threw a figure at the Nez Perce of, you know, need 5,000 in megawatts in solar, which is a little above the what their output has been. But the Nez Perce took that on, said, you know, we're going to do solar enough to do 10% of that. So they're doing 500 megawatts with a battery backup that got the first Tesla pack in Idaho, I think, delivered to them. And then they're working in conjunction with other tribes to add solar and to do a solar network to match the full 5,000 is what their goal is, 5,000 megawatts.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Marilee, go ahead, please.
Well, I just think that that's an important contribution because not only will breaching the dams enable tribes to return to lands that are historically significant to them culturally and spiritually, but it also will support the entrepreneurial efforts of the tribes to increase their economic well-being and support their tribal members. I think it's really interesting to think about salmon as not only a source of food, but they are a significant part of the cultural and spiritual traditions of these peoples. And the return of the salmon will allow them to return to practice many of their culturally significant rituals, which will strengthen the tribes. I don't know if you all know, but many tribes in the United States have returned to their traditional practices in order to move their young people, particularly away from substance abuse and other problems that afflict reservations. And this is a significant opportunity for us to contribute to that work here in the Northwest.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's see. On that note, thank you, Truman, for those questions. I will say, Don, regarding the advertising we're hearing about building more coal plants, I think most of our listeners know that in Washington state, coal plants are not going to be allowed to serve the electricity load in our state as soon as 2025, just 3 years from now. So we're not going to be seeing new coal plants in Washington state or to serve Washington's load. So that's a guarantee because of our legislature who stepped forward. I do want to make sure that since there is activity going on right now, decision makers are contemplating what they are going to do. So what would you recommend that people do in addition to a lower Snake River Dam removal sign in their yard? What can what can people do in addition to that?
Well, we believe, I'll let Don speak for himself, but we believe that the most important thing people can do right now is to contact Governor Inslee, Senator Murray, and Senator Cantwell, and let them know that we support the breaching of the lower Snake River dams, and we believe that the problems that arise can be solved, and that it's time for us to be problem solvers and get on with it. And let's just do it. We've been told that what they need to see is a tidal wave of public opinion. So we are about generating that tidal wave, wouldn't you say, Don?
Yes. An easy way to do that, if you want, is wildsalmon.org. And it will take you into the public comment on the draft report. There's suggested language there if you choose to use it. There's also for giving a response to Senator Cantwell and to President Biden. And so wildsalmon.org.
Wonderful.
There's one thing I feel applies to this situation. Jared Diamond, in his book, Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed, makes the comment, the values to which people cling most stubbornly under inappropriate conditions are those values that were previously the source of their greatest triumphs. I think, you know, when these dams were built, they were viewed as a triumph. We were told the fish ladders would, you know, keep the salmon runs. If not, we can do fish hatcheries. Those things have not proven true. And I think many of our endeavors in the 21st century are not going to help us survive in the 21st century. And Lower Snake River dams are an example of one of those things.
All right.
The other thing I would just want to encourage people to do is you can send a postcard to President Biden, to Senator Murray, Senator Cantwell, or Governor Inslee, and simply say, I support breaching the Lower Snake River dams.
All right.
We've been tabling at different places to get those sent. It's important that they hear from us. They're going to hear a lot from folks who don't want them breached. It's important that they hear from those of us who do.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on to the show, talking about an important issue that affects us in terms of the salmon and the environment and the southern resident orca, which of course are iconic, and we marvel every time we see them sent here around Vashon Island, and the Chinook salmon are so vital to their survival. So thank you. Truman.
Yeah, I'm not trying to be the devil's advocate here, but so the Chinook salmon, I mean, the Snake River empties into the Columbia into the Pacific Ocean. How does that affect our resident salmon? I mean, is that going to affect our salmon in the south?
So those salmon migrate up the Pacific coast into the Gulf of Alaska and then, you know, do the return migration back down. So that's areas that our southern residents feed. And in fact, the particular Chinook runs to the Columbia and Snake Rivers are, you know, one of the critical food sources for them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so their migration route, the orca and the salmon meet during the salmon migration route, and the orca, when the orcas transfer up north to feed. Because yeah. They're not down in southern sound all the time. They just tend to hang out here. Bruce, did you have a comment?
Yeah, can I jump in and just say, hey, what's important for us on Vashon Island is not that these dams are necessarily going to affect the resident orcas around Vashon specifically, but this movement on the Snake River is an exemplar for movements all over the country, all over the world, to basically readjust our relationship with nature. You know, Linda Mapes did a great job in an article she did in the Seattle Times about a week ago, sort of putting this in context. She also wrote a number of articles and wrote a book about the removal of the Elwha dams and how significant that was. And so we're at a turning point. And so the Snake River dams, for Vashon Islanders, it's important, but we're not going to see it right here next year, but we're going to see it in the future. We're going to see it all over the country. And so this is an exemplar turning point moment. That's what's significant about the Snake River dams to me.
I just want to say thank you for that, Bruce. I think that's really important. And I think that we can all look to the experience of the Elwha to understand that, in fact, the fears that were raised about what would happen in Port Angeles and the community served by the dams turned out not to be true. Port Angeles is thriving. Power needs were met, and the salmon returned so quickly. So we have an example right here in our state of how this can work to benefit all of us. And I think we should look to that.
Mm-hmm. Good points, and appreciate the clarification there on our local impact, because Truman, you raised a really good question there. So thanks for getting us to that point as well.
Hey, I was just going to say, Kevin, were you going to talk about our format at all or going forward or?
Well, I thank you for that invitation. Yeah, we have just a minute left here, but as we do move forward, you'll notice that Gail Kellner's last show was last week. Lynn Kerrigan will be hosting next week's show, and that will be Lynn's swan song show. So she is also moving on to other interests in her life. So Truman and Bruce and I, and we've extended invitations to others to join the Brieflies, but we'd also like to be able to bring focus of issues that are important to Vashon and Maury Islands by talking with local group leaders on the island about environmental issues, housing issues, and things of that nature. So give us some feedback on the new format. Most people know how to find me. If you don't know how to find me, ask one or two of your friends, progressive friends, and I'm sure that they can connect you. So, and if you don't know Truman, we've already mentioned Truman is ubiquitous on the islands. And of course, we all know our friend, historian Bruce Holman. So that's where we're headed. I hope you enjoy it. And we'll look forward to hosting from Lynn, and we'll carry on in the spirit of information about news you can use locally. So thank you.
Thanks
Thank
a lot.
You. Thank you.
Thanks to the guests. We really appreciate you guys being here today.
Thanks for having
Great
me.
Great to have you here, Don and Early.